You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Film critic Roger Ebert was once asked if he could name a movie entirely devoid of clichés. After thinking for a moment, he answered My Dinner with Andre. The Andre in the title of that film is the acclaimed actor, writer, and theater director Andre Gregory, and indeed, there is nothing conventional about him. After all, this is the man who made a two-hour film about two men talking in a restaurant, and once had a chemist create the stench of decaying flesh for a theater production of his. And even his new memoir is unconventional, with a title like This Is Not My Memoir. So today, Andre Gregory joins me on the show to talk about his unusual life, from his Jewish father's possible collaboration with the Nazis and his mom's affair with Errol Flynn, to the 14-year rehearsal of his production of Ibsen's The Master Builder, and the time the local sheriff escorted him out of his own repertory theater and dumped him across the state line in the middle of nowhere. We get into his longtime collaboration with actor-writer Wallace Shawn, how their conversations led to the iconic film My Dinner with Andre, and whether they've ever considered a sequel. Plus, we discuss how the movie presaged the chaos of the Trump era, how his production of a play that would never open became the hottest ticket on Broadway, and why he and Shawn will soon be bringing their talents to a podcast near you. Coming up with Andre Gregory in just a moment. Andre Gregory has been directing in New York for more than half a century. He is also an actor, writer, teacher, painter, and author of the poetry collection Bone Songs. He has collaborated with Wally Shawn and Louis Malle on the now iconic film My Dinner with Andre and Vanya on 42nd Street, based on his legendary production of Uncle Vanya that never opened. He later worked with Wally Shawn and Jonathan Demme on the filmed version of his production of Ibsen's The Master Builder. Some of his other credits as an actor on film include The Mosquito Coast, The Last Temptation of Christ, Demolition Man, Celebrity, and most recently, the HBO series The Young Pope. Now he's out with a rather unconventional memoir. In fact, the title says it all. This is not my memoir. Andre Gregory, thanks for joining me.
Hello.
Well, first off, Andre, why didn't you want to write a traditional memoir?
I guess I'm not a traditional kind of guy, even at 86 years old. And I did swear that the one thing I would never do as I get older was write a memoir. So I didn't want to call this a memoir. And then I think anyone reading it will see that it's not just entertaining, but it has a structure that is quite different from anything you've read before.
And you start the book by recounting your family's journey to America with quite a few stops along the way. If I have this right, I think you were born in Paris, but they originated in Russia. Is that right?
Yeah, my father went from Moscow to Berlin, to Paris, to London, to Scarsdale. It was quite a journey.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And this was during, you know, Nazi Germany and then the Soviet Union. And despite the fact that your family was Jewish, you reveal in your book that you've long suspected that your father had some not so kosher relationships with leadership in Nazi Germany. What do you base that on?
Well, I base it on a Princeton historian who did a study, I think, of economics in Germany. And he came across the name of my father and his brothers as three people who may have collaborated with Hitler. My wife did a wonderful film, Andre Gregory, Before and After Dinner, which has a lot more about that subject than my book does. But then I guess since making that film, which was about 10 years ago, I've become more forgiving to my father, so I didn't emphasize it as much in the book as I could have.
You have various reasons for having a difficult relationship with your dad and eventually coming to terms with that. But how much of that had to do with the fact that he may or may not have had ties with Nazis? And how do you begin to grapple with something like that?
No, it was, I only discovered that about 10 years ago. So okay. I think my early years, I might have been resentful of both my mother and father, who I nicknamed Lord and Lady Macbeth. They were not the most supportive of parents. My father hated the fact that I'd become an artist. And a few years after My Dinner with Andre appeared, we had one of our many fights. And my wife, a little worried about how he was taking it, went up to see him. And he said, I don't understand what's wrong with Andre. What's his problem with me? Why does he always get so upset? And she said, well, I think he feels sometimes you don't respect him. And he said, don't respect him? Of course I respect him. He could have been a great lawyer.
I love that. That's almost like a Jewish mom joke right there, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Are you Jewish?
No, but I'm an aspiring Jew, let's put it that way.
Oh, good. Okay.
Now, as a child, you moved to New York and you were enrolled in a very WASPy private school in New York. Did you encounter a lot of anti-Semitism there?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. My brother and I kind of pretended we were aristocratic white Russians so we could get by, because it wasn't pleasant there.
Your family changed your last name, right, as well?
They changed the last name partly for that reason, mm-hmm. and partly because the name Josefovitz would have been a little hard for my dad as a businessman. Mm-hmm. But you know, it wasn't just the school. There was a lot of anti-Semitism in New York. My late wife and I, when we were young, tried to buy an apartment on Upper Fifth Avenue in New York. And we were turned down by the board because they knew I was Jewish.
So when would that have been? In the 60s or 70s, I guess, even?
Yeah, 60s. But I worked with a rabbi. Later, studied Hebrew. And the rabbi asked me if I would come and address the annual dinner for Orthodox rabbis and their wives. And I said, well, of course I would, but what the hell would I talk about? And he said, oh, you know, talk about movies. Everybody loves to hear about movies. And as I was entering the hotel where the ballroom was, I realized, oh my God, this is where, as a teenager, I used to go to fancy, swanky debutante parties. And so I just improvised the talk, and I talked to this group. I said to them, you know, I'm an anti-Semite. I was brought up as an anti-Semite. And I want to tell you this evening what it feels like to be an anti-Semite. They loved it. They just loved it.
In other words, what you're calling an anti-Semite is what others might call a self-loathing Jew back then?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, on the other hand, when you weren't in school, you described these charmed summers that you would spend here in Los Angeles, getting invited to watch Basil Rathbone record his radio show and all of these glamorous celebrity-filled parties that your parents hosted at their summer home on Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, the Marx Brothers, wow. Abbott and Costello, Fred Astaire, Dietrich, Garbo. It was quite a group.
Yeah. Did you ever get to meet the Marx Brothers? What were they like?
You know, I was too young to remember, but I did meet them. Well, I do remember, you know, without Harpo's curly hair and without Groucho's mustache, they kind of looked like ordinary people. They looked as if they could have been businessmen.
Yeah, I always heard that, because you were a young boy, I always heard that Harpo was very good with children.
You know, I think he was very sweet with children. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, is it true that your mom had an affair with Errol Flynn and I think also possibly Bugsy Siegel?
No, she didn't have. Bugsy Siegel, of course, was the guy who started Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And she used to go and play gin rummy with him once a week. And one night they'd had a late game until about 3 a.m. She went home. And when she woke up in the morning, the headline in the LA Times was Bugsy Siegel, mobster, assassinated, shot in the back of his head. So wow. He'd been killed a little while after she left, but they were not lovers. Errol Flynn, she and Errol Flynn were lovers. In fact, I caught her in the garden one day, kissing Errol Flynn behind a bush. And I said to her, if you're not nicer to me, I'm going to tell my dad what you're doing.
You blackmailed your mother.
Yes, I was probably an awful little kid.
Yeah, and I think there was a good story in here about when you go back to New York, none of your friends believe you when you tell them that you've met all these movie stars. And she brings in Errol Flynn into the picture. Huh?
Well, that was something really lovely that my mother did for me, because the other kids were starting to beat me up because they didn't believe that I knew Errol Flynn. So my mother got the idea of inviting Flynn for lunch and a representative of the school for lunch, who could see that, in fact, it was true. Lunch was at 1. By 2:30, Errol Flynn still hadn't arrived. My reputation was on the line. I was probably doomed. So my mother got into a taxi, went to the Waldorf Astoria, where he was staying, but they didn't want to let her into his room. So she said, I'm pregnant with Flynn's child. And if you don't let me into the room, I'm going to let it be known by the newspapers. So they let her into the room. He was in bed with a hooker. She dragged him out of bed, put him in a shower, sobered him up, brought him up to our apartment, and he signed a picture to the class. So my reputation was saved.
And now, was this part of the reason for your interest in the theater, all of these movie stars that were around? Or what first got you interested in going into the theater?
Well, I'm sure it had some kind of an effect on me. How can it not have? But it was really acting in a school play, playing Petruchio in The Taming of the Shrew when I was 12. That started my passion for theater.
Yeah, I don't think this is in the book, but I heard somewhere that there was also an Audrey Hepburn connection. Is that right? Can you tell? I love that story.
Oh, yeah, that's a great story. When we lived in New York, and when I was 14, the elevator man was also a bookie. And I think I got 50 cents a week as an allowance from my dad. And I put my savings into betting on the races. And I won the Daily Double. That's where you win, I think, the first race and the second race. So I suddenly had about $200. And I used to listen to a radio drama called the United States Steel Hour, which I loved. So not really knowing what the hell United States Steel was, I invested the $200 into United States Steel shares, which split, the shares split. So that left me a tidy little nest egg. And I put it in the savings bank, and one night my parents took me to see Audrey Hepburn's first play on Broadway.
Wow.
I fell so in love with her that I started spending my savings on sending her one rose every night with an anonymous note saying, I love you. Years later, I was doing my production of Alice in Wonderland at the Spoleto Festival in Italy. When it was over, this beautiful young woman came up to say how much she'd loved the production, and she had an uncanny resemblance to Audrey Hepburn. So obviously, she was Audrey Hepburn's daughter. And I said, you must be Audrey Hepburn's daughter. And she said, no, I'm Audrey Hepburn. And we went out for tea in this ancient piazza. And as the tea was ending, I said to her, you know, I'm sure you wouldn't remember this, but years ago, and she said, oh my God, are you the one? I've been waiting all these years for you to appear.
I wonder what her impression was when she received the roses. I wonder if she thought that you were some kind of stalker or 40-year-old man or what.
Well, she could have thought that until about the 40th or 50th rose.
Yeah.
When all that showed up was a rose and not a stalker.
Okay. Yeah.
I think she felt it was incredibly romantic, which of course, I guess it was.
When you got into acting, how much of it was just getting a release for your anger against your parents and that the anti-Semitism, sort of the unfairness of, you know, things like this WASPy school that you were going to? How much of
it was a great release because I was a polite, repressed young man, and being able to let out all of that fury and all of that bottled up stuff in a performance was a huge relief.
You got into theater, you went to Harvard Radcliffe, studied with a number of different people. You talk about having these heroes, some of which were dead before you even could meet them, such as Bertolt Brecht, and you spent some time at the Berliner Ensemble, which is sort of a temple to Brecht. One of your heroes who you did get to meet was, of course, Jerzy Grotowski, who was this very famous Polish director. He's one of these examples of you finding a hero and then tracking him down and actually getting to meet them. How did you meet him?
I had this dream about creating an actor who can fly. And I was talking about that with someone, and she said, oh, maybe you should go to Poland and meet the director Grotowski. I think he might take you a new step towards an actor who can fly. So I went all the way to Poland. It was not easy in those days. And of course, Grotowski was gone for the summer. So I roamed around Europe, had a pretty good time, and knew that his company would be performing at the Edinburgh Festival in the fall. So I got tickets for 12 performances. I was staggered. He was clearly the Michelangelo of theater. And every night I send him a note. That's my habit, you see. I said, I would like to meet you. And he didn't answer till the very last night. He said, I could see you tomorrow after the performance for about 3 minutes. And he asked me a few questions, and that was it. And then about 5 months later, I guess, when I was back in New York, the phone rang. And this voice said, hello, this is Jerzy. I'd like you to come and do a workshop with us. And that was the beginning of a lifelong friendship.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. And now before we get to my dinner with Andre and some of your other things, I want to talk about some of your early work. At a certain point, you decided to create your own theater company in Philadelphia, and you spent 3 years raising money for it. And then your first production, I'll be honest, it almost sounds like the plot of Mel Brooks' The Producers. It gives new meaning to the word transgressive. What did you do with that play that your board and audiences found so objectionable?
There's a long description of it in the book, and this production was incredibly flamboyant, theatrical, and as you say, transgressive. Perhaps The interesting thing for now is that the board fired me for doing this play. And I said, you can't fire me. You're my board of directors. I created you. And they said, well, we're not going to pay you anymore. And I said, okay, don't pay me. I'm going to stay and work. So after a couple of days, I noticed from the window of my office upstairs that a paddy wagon, a police wagon, had shown up. And sure enough, the police were there to arrest me. They put me in the wagon. They took me across the state line to New Jersey, dropped me in the middle of nowhere, and I had to hitchhike back home in Philadelphia. So it was a rude ending to what had been, I think, a terrific theater.
Yeah. After that, you started another company called the Manhattan Project at what I think was the brand new Tisch School of Acting. You directed this now legendary production of Alice based on the stories of Lewis Carroll. That has to have been an exceedingly challenging project. To enter the world of Lewis Carroll is kind of to enter the world of absolute madness. And it's one of those things where, you know, if you're going to do a theater production of it, it either has to be a $50,000 production or a $10 million production. There's kind of no way to do it in between without doing it half-assed. Talk about your decision to do the stripped-down version.
Well, I was very fascinated by what was unique to theater. In other words, theater and film were, the theater was at war with film, trying to be as big as film. So there would be huge sets, revolving stages, thousands of lights. I was fascinated to see what could you do without anything. And Alice posed a great challenge that way. You know, a white rabbit appears. Well, how does an actor perform a white rabbit with no makeup and no rabbit costume? Oh, my ears and whiskers, he says, it's getting late. And he goes down a rabbit hole. How do you create a rabbit hole without a movie camera when there's nothing on the stage?
Exactly.
Alice falls down the rabbit hole. How does she fall into a hole that doesn't exist? So I was fascinated by how to create all of that.
Yeah, and I think it ran for something like 3 years, right? And it toured all over.
Oh, at least. Yeah, went all over the world, traveled all over the United States. It was one of the hallmark productions of the 1970s.
Yeah.
And one of the most difficult things I ever did.
Yeah. Now, after the disillusion of the Manhattan Project, you go through sort of a seeker period, spending time with gurus in places like Tunisia and Dar es Salaam. And a lot of these are the stories that make it into your now famous movie, My Dinner with Andre. I definitely want to talk
about my now famous book, This Is Not My Memoir.
And the book, yes. People will recognize some stories in there from the movie. And if I have this right, the conversations that make up My Dinner with Andre were never originally intended to be a movie. You and Wally Shawn just started having these talks almost, I don't know, sort of as an exercise or what?
No. Actually, Wally intended it to be a film.
Okay.
Which, of course, was incredibly arrogant because even if we were able to make it into a film or a film script, how would we ever raise money?
Right.
For a movie in which two men do nothing but talk. And if we did make it into a movie, how in God's name would anybody except our friends and families want to see it? So the fact that it became iconic and has been now seen, I guess, by three generations since it first came out, still seems to me like a miracle.
Yeah, you described the raising of money for this film as kind of the most excruciating process of your life. What did people say to you when you said, hey, I need some money so I can go and make this film that's a two-hour conversation between, at that time, two totally unknown actors?
Oh, well, there was one lovely guy who had invested in most of my theater productions. And when I sent him the script, he called me and he said, I am really hurt. How, after all this time, would you expect me to invest in this ridiculous piece of garbage? Wow. That was the kind of response we got. But we raised the money. We did raise the money.
Yeah. And I always assumed that you shot My Dinner with Andre in an actual restaurant in Manhattan, but that's not the case. Where did you film it?
No, we filmed it in an abandoned hotel, a grand, grand hotel, which had not been operating for years in Richmond, West Virginia. We could have never done it in a restaurant because we never had the kind of budget that would have allowed us to film in a restaurant for even one night. And this hotel was amazing. The grand staircase that went in two directions up to the third floor was the original staircase in Gone with the Wind, when Rhett Butler carries her up the stairs and says, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn."
Wow.
And there were crocodile pools in the lobby without crocodiles in them, because it had been years since the place had been operative. And it was in December, so we couldn't afford to heat the room we were shooting in, because we would have had to heat the whole hotel. So Wally and I were wearing electric blankets. The crew was wearing ski clothes. And it was more like shooting a nature film in the Arctic than doing My Dinner with Andre.
Yeah, that's wonderfully ironic that you were both wearing electric blankets under the table, if anyone's seen the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a major centerpiece of the conversation at a certain point.
Right.
Now, here's the thing that I've always wondered about My Dinner with Andre. And you know what? I don't think that I'm alone. How come no one orders dessert in My Dinner with Andre?
Oh, good question. You got me there. I don't know.
You have an appetizer and an entree, right? But no dessert.
Yeah.
Could you, maybe I guess, because it would have been a three-hour movie then?
Yeah, probably.
Now, Louis Malle, the great Louis Malle, directed this film. And I think you say in here that he only gave you one piece of advice, one direction when you were making that film. What was it?
Speak faster. And I said to Louis, "Is that because my performance is boring?" And he said, "No." He said, you're doing theater acting, which is different from film acting, because film acting is very, very simple. And if you spoke faster, you wouldn't think about acting. And you've done so much rehearsing that the camera, which picks up everything, will see the performance in your eyes. So it's about doing less. And it's the same direction, he said, that John Huston gave to his dad, Walter Huston. When Walter Huston was acting in The Treasure of Sierra Madre. And it was a performance that got Huston an Oscar. Wow. My performance did not get me an Oscar. And that's because we weren't a part of the union at that time.
Oh, that's funny. That's interesting. I never thought about that. But the film kind of had a slow start to it in terms of its release. But I think, as I recall, it was really Siskel and Ebert who put My Dinner with Andre on the map, right?
Yeah, until Siskel and Ebert, there'd been reviews from, say, Time magazine, which said this is a boring, uneven movie by amateur actors with no director and no script. Avoid it if you can. The New York Times said, this is a Winnie the Pooh kind of fable, if you like that sort of thing, which I don't. So the reviews had been awful until Siskel and Ebert got behind it and made it history.
I read in an interview that you gave with Siskel and Ebert, and I think Wally Shawn was in this too, they asked you if you would have done anything differently with that film. And you said you would switch parts with Wally. Now that would
have been fun. Yeah. That would have been great.
Yeah. I mean, can we take that to mean that maybe you're playing more of a character than most people might assume?
Oh, I'm totally playing a character. This yeah. is, I play a character based on Andre, mm-hmm. who is more manic, more narcissistic, more driven than I actually am in real life.
Mm-hmm. You know, I tend to think that the political themes in My Dinner with Andre are lost on many viewers, but you talk about a lot of stuff in that film that seems very relevant today. Things like income inequality, the rise of fascism in the form of corporate totalitarianism, how Americans are in this dreamlike state of ignorance about everything that's going on, and we need to wake ourselves up. Do you think that you presaged the moment that we've been living in over the past few years? And
no, it was a preview of coming attractions, which have not been pretty over the last 4 years. And fascism is mentioned all the way through the movie. But of course, when it came out, because we weren't anywhere near fascism at that point, people sort of thought it was just funny. But there is a scene in which I talk about Americans going to sleep and how that could lead to fascism and New York being the new model for the new concentration camp.
Right.
We had 6 million hits on the internet. I think from a lot of people who never saw the movie and didn't know who we were, because it was so relevant to what was unfortunately going on in this country.
Interesting. And it feels like it's even more so now. I mean, everyone's going around with their faces in their phones instead of having real conversations and noticing what's going on in the world around them.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I might be paraphrasing. I'm not sure if I have this right, but I think that you also in that film mourn the lack of chaos in modern American life.
Yeah, I don't remember saying that, but God knows America has been unspeakably chaotic for the last 4 years. And it still is, because people insanely will not wear masks, will not keep their distance, and will not realize that we're living in the midst of a plague. So there's still a lot of chaos.
Have you and Wally ever talked of doing a sequel?
We never would, because Louis isn't still with us. But a lot of people have suggested a sequel. And at one point, I thought it would be kind of fun if Wally got to be 81 years old and I got to be 90 years old. If these two elderly gentlemen would be sitting in rocking chairs on the porch of one of those wonderful old Adirondacks hotels, mm-hmm. a bit like the hotel you have where you're living now. And if we talked and talked and talked about the one thing we did not talk about in My Dinner with Andre, sex.
Right.
I think that could have been fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? You guys should start a podcast. How about my podcast with Andre?
I just completed directing two podcasts of two of Wally's greatest plays.
No kidding.
The Designated Mourner and Grasses of a Thousand Colors.
Oh,
and they're beautiful. And they should be coming out in the next few months. So keep an eye open for it.
Yeah. Do you know where those are going out?
I don't.
Where we'll be able. Okay. That's definitely something to look forward to. Now, how long have you and Wally been working together? I mean, you've had one of the longest creative collaborations in history, I think, right?
Yeah. We've been working together for 50 years.
Wow.
And we've only had one 12-minute disagreement in all of that time. We are a great marriage.
What was the disagreement about? Do you remember?
I don't. I don't. But you know, a great collaborator is sent to you from God. Mm-hmm. And over these many years, he's become my dearest friend in the world. And sometimes I enter projects with him just to be with him.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's somewhere in the book where you say that when you're not working with Wally in the same room, you dream about working with Wally.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Especially during COVID.
Yeah. What are conversations between you and Wally like these days? Are they vastly different from the kind of chats that inspired My Dinner with Andre?
No, I think they're somewhat similar. We talk about politics a lot.
Yeah, I think everyone has gotten more political over the past 4 years than they ever imagined they'd be.
I would hope so.
Now, there's a great moment in My Dinner with Andre where Wally says to you, I really have no idea what you're talking about. And mm-hmm. I was sort of amused to read in the book that those words are usually your reaction whenever you first read one of Wally's plays, right?
Right.
First, you don't know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Why is it hard for you to delve into it at first? Or what?
Well, because Wally is a great poet of the theater.
Right.
And as you know, poetry often seems ambiguous. Mm-hmm. We're taught at school that we're supposed to understand poems. But that's not really true, I don't think. You have to listen to poems the way you listen to music. So it's when you listen to music, it would be very hard to say, I'm listening to this or that, you know. Mm-hmm. So they're dense, they're profound, and they're difficult.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention another collaboration between you and Wally, which is Uncle Vanya, which rehearsed on and off for about 4 years. And interestingly, you and all involved, including Wally and Julianne Moore, agreed that it would never be publicly performed. I'm fascinated by that. Why would anyone do that?
It was really the actors. Wally said, no, I don't want to do Vanya. I'm not a good enough actor to do Vanya. And I said, well, what if we never did it? If we just did it for the fun of it? And he said, oh, that would be great. And then when I asked Julianne Moore to do it, she said, no, I've decided to give up the theater. A lot of the scripts I'm reading aren't good. A lot of the directors aren't good. And I said, well, how about doing this as your farewell to theater, and we wouldn't even have to perform it. She said, oh, that would be great. I'd love to do that. So many of the other actors I approached had the same feelings. So the idea was we would never perform it.
That's fascinating. So it was all about the work itself.
Right.
And yet it became sort of this huge underground hit, because I guess you did mm-hmm. sort of private workshops of the play, and it became the hottest ticket in town, right?
Yeah, well, it did, because if you want to go see something and you can't get in, mm-hmm. you assume it's great and you'll do anything to get a ticket. So it did become a very hot ticket, yeah.
In the book, you refer to Vanya as your most autobiographical work. And I think you say that every role in that play corresponds to someone in your own life. Can you walk mm-hmm. us through the characters and their real life counterparts for you?
The part that George Gaines played of the older professor, that was my father, Larry Pine, playing the alcoholic doctor, was my Uncle George. The role Julianne Moore played was my mother. They all turned out in retrospect to have been autobiographical figures.
That's so fascinating. And I want to quote something that I found so insightful that you say about Chekhov's plays. You say that they're about the very human error of yearning for what we can never have instead of celebrating right. what we do have. Now, from the last chapters of your book, it sounds like you've finally crossed over to that latter state. Are you pretty content these days? You're now 86, right?
I'm 86, yeah. Well, I am content. You know, I have a wonderful wife who's incredibly creative. I have some good books, a roof over my head. And, you know, I have friends who are saying, oh, my God, when are we going to be able to go back into the world again? Mm-hmm. And when is COVID going to end? Well, sure, especially for people who are economically strapped. This is very, very tough.
Yeah.
But a lot of Americans are very spoiled, except for the Civil War. We've never had war on our shores. We've never had our cities bombed the way many all over the world have. And I just try to be grateful for what I have. one of the things you really have to look forward to at 86 is being under the ground instead of over the ground. So that's not great to look forward to. So, you know, I just tried to enjoy today.
Yeah. Although you have been under the ground once.
I have.
Strange exercise, which I think is referenced in the movie and is in the book if anyone wants to revisit that story. Before we go, I have to ask about this production of Hedda Gabler that you and Wally have been working on. Now, you're famous for these long rehearsals such as Uncle Vanya and I think the 14-year rehearsal for The Master Builder. You're 86 right now. How old do you think you'll be when you will finally make Hedda Gabler?
Well, especially with COVID, so we can't rehearse.
Right.
I guess I'd be about 104 or 5.
Well, I hope we live to see it. Maybe I
me want, too.
Would you and Wally think about doing that one as a podcast as well, maybe?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Once again, the book is called This Is Not My Memoir. Andre Gregory, thanks so much for talking with me.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. You're very sophisticated.
Thanks again to Andre Gregory for coming on the show. Order his new book, This Is Not My Memoir, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.